Does Monday at the office feel like a storm? Not with Microsoft Copilot. That feeling when Copilot gets everyone up to speed instantly? It's sunny again. When Copilot simplifies complex data so your teams can act, that sun's shining on a beach. And when Copilot uncovers hidden insights, you're on that beach with your people and you find buried treasure. That's Microsoft Copilot. Learn more at Microsoft.com/AI for all.
Did I ever take you in my arms, look you in the eye, tell you that I do? Did I ever open up my heart, let you look inside? If I never did it, I was only waiting for a better moment that didn't come. There never could be a better moment.
So this is Robert Rodriguez, and you're listening to Something About the Beatles, and this is a special episode taped at the 2015 Fest for Beatle Fans in Rosemont, Illinois. And you just heard the song This One from 1989's Flowers in the Dirt album by Paul McCartney. It's one of these rare songs of agreement that Richard and I both rank up there as one of Paul's best solo recordings. Right now I'm looking for the guy who's been pretty much a ghost this weekend. We're supposed to be doing a taping, and I'm not sure where he is, but you know, right now I'm checking out the marketplace where the shirts are sold, and the calendars, and the Beatles stockings, and lanyards, and anything you can imagine. And I don't seem to see him. I know he was supposed to be here by now, Let's see. He's not out in the hallway. At least I don't see him. Of course, I have to look over people's heads because he's not really a tall guy. If you know what I mean. Let's see. Is that... No, that's not him. That's a woman. No, that's a child. It's got to be... Oh, is that... That? No. Oh, man, he's got to be down here somewhere. Maybe head down the room we're supposed to be in. Maybe he turned up while I wasn't here. Anyway, we had started talking earlier about the Lollapalooza show Paul had done, and we got to hear a bit of the sound check while it was happening, and I thought it was a pretty cool thing. And, you know, Richard went on his normal bent about, well, his voice is gone. You know, what's he doing up on the stage? And it started this whole discussion, and maybe some of you people listening saw the show or saw a recent Paul show. And, you know, there are some people think, oh, you know, he should quit because his voice isn't what it was in 1989 or 1976. And, you know, I personally would rather have him out there doing it. You know, some people are saying, you know, well, you know, Michael Jordan played basketball too long. It's a bit like that. Oh, and there's Richard.
Obviously, the fans are still turning out. People want to hear him and see him, and I understand that.
But, and that's my position. You know, yeah, his voice is not what it was. I mean, if you listen to the Twickenham tapes.
Twickenham. Twickenham.
I said Twickenham. Did I say that?
You said Twickenham, yeah.
Petum. Bad finger. he's talking in January 1969 that he'd lost something in his singing capacity going back to the club days. Hmm. And he was like, you know, lamenting that, you know, I can't do this as easily as I once did. So I have to think on some level he must be conscious of what he's lost now.
Well, he's such a perfectionist, Paul. Okay.
Yes.
You know, with Live Aid in 1985, when they had a dropout on the microphone,
yes,
he was in the studio the next day redoing his vocal.
Right. Good for him.
And so I'm just kind of surprised that at this point he's willing to put out material, recorded material, where the voice is so fragile. It just surprises me.
You know, having seen him now, we saw the sound check before Lollapalooza, and I saw him at Miller Park a couple years ago when he toured. In a stadium situation, blasting through the PA, it's not real evident the deterioration in his voice. I mean, he can almost get away with it.
Right.
And he did, you know, that particular tour, he did a lot of stuff off Wings Over America, which had just been reissued. And it didn't sound bad at all. You weren't, like, cringing when you heard it. So, but when you hear his speaking voice, it's just, in some settings, even Saturday Night Live, where all the flaws become more evident.
Yeah, and also, you know, like the opening of the London Olympics.
Ladies and gentlemen, Paul McCartney!
Start to make it better. Hey, Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, you begin to make it better.
You know, I mean, I was just cringing, and I wasn't sitting there. I'm a Beatle fan, right? You know, and I want him to be great all the time.
Sure.
And people to love him. And so I was just sitting there and just cringing.
Yeah.
The same at the Grammys, where I think he did Golden Slumbers.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And Ringo wasn't there, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think, on the whole, I don't think even going out now, not sounding bad, or sounding as he is, if it's quite evident. I think he can be forgiven. I don't think it's going to take away from his legacy all that much. Mm. I mean, George was half his age when he went on a Dark Horse tour.
Oh, God, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, he survived that.
Yes, that's true.
And I think it's important that if you are this connection to the Beatle past, you're still capable. You've got the deepest of catalogs to draw from, and there's still plenty of people walking the earth who've never seen a Beatle live, an ex-Beatle live,
yeah,
and they're bringing their kids. You know, why the hell not?
Here I am talking negatives about Paul, but the greatness of the man, I mean, it was never more evident than back in the 90s, I think it was. I was still living in London, and he did a gig at the Mean Fiddler. So you may know the date of that. It's about like 93, I think, something like that. And it's like about 100 people there. And he said, I feel like I'm in my front parlor. You know, it was just like, it was about as big as this room maybe. And so we were like right near the stage. And when it's not that stadium or arena setting, and he's in a venue like that, and it's like, well, here's another one I did, Hey Jude. Mm-hmm. And here's another one yesterday, and here's Lady Madonna, and here's, you know, mm-hmm. And it's like, wow. Then you realize the genius of the man.
Mm. Very good. Let me see your list again.
My list again, okay.
Yeah, because there were some things in there I thought warranted some comment. It's interesting, you know, there's a few things here that certainly would be on my greatest hits. Junior's Farm, High, 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 probably, although I do prefer the Wings live version over the studio single. No More Lonely Nights in this one, great pieces of work he did. Cut Me Some Slack, surprise inclusion, I'm glad you have that. Say, 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 I Can Safely Live the Rest of My Life and Never Hear Again.
You are, you know, I'm trying to put together a whole album.
Right.
You know, I didn't want to do an EP.
Are you suggesting you're scraping the bottom of the barrel?
I am in some ways. They're not necessarily songs that I would be listening to that much.
Is there a particular solo album of Paul's you gravitate toward as if you're going to listen to one start to finish, that would be the one?
Wow, that's a really good question. The answer is most likely no. I've only really got a handful of Paul tracks on my iPod, you know, and on my phone. And
but your challenge was to come up with the Paul greatest hits.
Yeah, and I managed to come up with more than an EP. You know, isn't that good? I mean, I came up with an album.
That's more than two singles.
Absolutely. Should I tell you what I start with? Or do you want me to run
through? Why don't you we'll run down the list, and then we'll discuss along the way.
Okay, so these aren't the songs that I'm saying should be on a McCartney greatest hits album. They're the ones that I would choose for my own listening. So we start with High, High, High.
Interesting choice.
Live and Let Die. Let Me Roll It. Junior's Farm, which I'll get to later. I love the song, not the lyrics. Here Today. Take It Away. Wanderlust, which I think is an absolute classic. I think it's a fantastic song. Tug of War. Say, Say, Say. No More Lonely Nights, This One, Put It There, Young Boy, Little Willow, Beautiful Night, again qualified with the lyrics, and Cut Me Some Slack with the guys from Nirvana.
Wow, that's a real curve you threw in there at the end, but I must say, there are certain things I'm surprised just because they seem so ubiquitous in the Paul catalog is like maybe oversaturated, and things that I would think you would immediately tune out just because they are so overfamiliar. Live and Let Die jumps out at me.
Right, and you know, when I heard him do it at the sound check the other week, it could have really put me off, but it's still, I think it's a great Bond theme number. He came up with the goods there. He was asked to do a, you know, James Bond theme, and he really did one of the great ones,
Input from Linda.
Absolutely,
who wrote that reggae break, apparently. What Does It Matter to You?
And it's still great to see it live with all, you know, the pyrotechnics and everything. So
he's been doing that since the song first came out. And I always thought it would be interesting to see a Paul McCartney live show where he does Live and Let Die and doesn't do the pyrotechnics. He just plays it like any other song and see all the people in the audience go, what? Just to throw them a curve and be surprising for once, because you know a surprise at a Paul McCartney show, with all due respect, is a rare thing.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Cut Me Some Slack. Some people just hated it. I just think the state of his voice now, he should be doing more of that.
And did you give this a title?
Yeah, Paul McCartney's Greatest Hits.
Oh, it resonates. Okay.
But you know,
apart from what I just mentioned, I think those are the ones that definitely I would have in mind. There's some songs, Tug of War, I'm not a big fan of. Take It Away, I was never a big fan of, with all due respect. Little Willow's great. Put It There, great one. That's
yeah,
I
mean, you know, here's the issue I have with Paul in his solo career. Mm. I think Junior's Farm is a fantastic rocker. Love it. Great solo by Jimmy McCulloch. There's a however coming. It's the lyrics. You know, we've got, let's listen to these lyrics from the guy who wrote Hey Jude and Lady Madonna. I was talking to an Eskimo, said he was hopping for a fall of snow when up popped a sea lion ready to go.
Should he be singing Inuit?
At the Houses of Parliament, everybody talking about the president, we all chip in for a bag of cement.
Well, who was president when he sang that?
But why a bag of cement?
Have you never seen a gangster film?
Oh,
they have those in England?
I mean, really? Ollie Hardy should have had more sense. He bought a Gigi and he jumped the fence, all for the sake of a couple of pence.
See, I'm certain that means something to someone who lived in England.
Well, I did live in England. It means nothing. I took my bag into a grocer's store. The price is higher than the time before. Old man asked me, why is it more?
Whip inflation now.
I mean, what did you compare this to, this sort of style of writing?
Well, if you throw a bunch of phrases together that scan well and you can sing well,
yeah,
and they sound good in part of the whole ensemble put together,
yeah,
you know, that's not a terrible thing. I mean, does that make less sense than I Am the Walrus? Does it make less sense than Glass Onion?
But I Am the Walrus is great poetry. This isn't.
You'd call it great poetry, would you?
Yeah, I would.
I think it's, again, I think all things being equal, it's a bunch of beautifully crafted phrases that sound great, set against a wonderful arrangement and production job.
But they create great visuals.
Yeah.
You know, that's John's...
You don't think that's visual?
No, I think it's rubbish.
Oh, my God. Have you seen the sheet music to that? It's got Denny Lane in the... suit and...
Did I catch you the other week saying that this was Dylan-esque?
No.
Ah, you're getting yourself off the hook.
No, but I will tell you this.
He did say that.
I did not say that. This is what I made the point of saying. This is a known thing. I'm not just pulling this out of someplace. Dylan, who had these great impenetrable lyrics that, you know, made him the spokesman for a generation because people could read whatever the hell they wanted into them, he would cut up newspapers and magazines and words and lay them out on the floor and string these things together. That literally is true. And it does not take away from his art or his craftsmanship, because anybody can do that and not get the same results.
I mean, when you said Dylan, maybe, you know, his cousin Bert Dylan or something.
Well,
I mean,
yes,
really.
For all you know. I didn't say Zimmerman.
Yeah, but I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned.
You know, and then... I've got another song that I actually really like the melody of is Beautiful Night, and I like the fact that Ringo's on there, and not only we hear his drumming, we hear his vocals.
Someone's gone out fishing, someone's high and dry, someone's on a mission to the lonely Lorelei. Some folks got a vision of a castle in the sky, and I'm left stranded wondering why. You and me together, nothing feels so good. Even if I get a medal from a local neighborhood, I won't need a castle. They've got castles in Versailles, and I'm still stranded wondering why. Make it a beautiful night for me. It's a beautiful night for love. Such a wonderful sight for lovers of love to be home. Yeah. Night.
Away on your way. Thank you.
Love the videos they did for that. Did a couple of videos. But again, you and me together, nothing feels so good. Even if I get a medal from my local neighborhood, I won't need a castle. They've got castles in Versailles. No, they don't. They don't have castles in Versailles. They have one palace.
A palace.
I'm still stranded wondering why, which is the disclaimer. It's like I can say any nonsense and they right. go, like, tell me, darling, what does it mean, you know? It's like, God, Paul, you know, make some effort.
Well, it displays Hugh's consciousness, his consciousness of the meaninglessness of it by ending it that way. He knew what he was doing.
Oh, so the meaninglessness is actually a bonus, is it?
It's something. If you're conscious of it. Because then you can't accuse him of throwing out nonsense and not even realizing
it. Are you
it.
Listening to this? I mean, are you hearing this?
Really, it makes perfect sense.
Actually, it is the meaninglessness of what you're saying.
Right.
Here. Yeah.
It's crafted meaningless. Less.
Okay, let's see your Lennon list.
Okay. Now, granted, you had 40-odd years of solo material to work from.
And I struggled with it.
Yeah, I know. You would say that you needed every year of that. I have 5 years of post-Beatle Lennon to work with, so my hill was a little steeper than yours.
Well done, well done.
You like that?
Yeah.
Okay. And to further make it a challenge to myself, I could have easily pulled together a Lennon greatest hits. It would probably not look like your greatest hits, because you're a everything including the kitchen stove kind of guy. So like any song you ever like would make it to this 28-track album. That's what you did with the Second Guessing the Beatles.
Am I getting insulted here?
No. Yeah. I'm saying our one of us has a loose criteria, the other is a little more stringent.
One of us is
just
into
saying.
Meaninglessness, yes.
Okay. No, one of us sets the bar high. So a hits collection for John that I would put together, and I didn't program this. This is just my putting together hits that I thought were worthy of a single collection. Slipping and Sliding. Everything on this is stuff that either was a single or, in the case of Slipping and Sliding, was a single that got canceled. Meat City, B-side. Move Over, Miss L, B-side. Instant Karma, which I think is one of the greatest things he ever did, straight out of the box. It's So Hard from Imagine. Number 9 Dream.
Yeah.
One of the most wonderfully Beatlesque recordings he ever did.
And so different to everything else that he did in his solo career, including on the Walls and Bridges album. It just stands out.
Which is why I make the case, and I think you agree with this, oddly enough, that Walls and Bridges is this overlooked gem,
yeah.
The same way that Ram was for years and years. That
No, I don't agree with that, but anyway.
Yeah, you're on the record for that. It went to number one. It had a number one hit single, but its success was very transitory at the time. I mean, you know, how much of it really had to do with Elton John singing on that single? It was the biggest rock star on the planet at the time.
Yeah.
But that sort of masked the fact that, number one, it was a wonderful musical statement from start to finish as a whole. And I liken it in my books to, you know, sort of a throwback to the 50s stuff that Frank Sinatra was doing in the Wee Lonely Hours, stuff like that, where it was this sort of mature adult theme, exploration of coming of age and blah, blah, blah. You know, that's, I don't know if that was very far from his mind when he was putting that collection together. But then he dismissed it repeatedly when he was promoting Double Fantasy. You know, and what is it? The one album he didn't make with Yoko at his side, so he's got to, you know, bury it.
But he did that with some of his Beatle numbers. That
he did too.
Like,
but I'm saying,
Hey Bulldog, right?
Singularly, this singular success in his solo career. John Lennon was making singles outside the Beatles longer than the rest of him. Yet it took him the longest to get a number one. And you know, this should have been a proud moment for him. It should have been a proud achievement. And yet he's so dismissive of it. You know, it just. I see the reasoning why he might have been trying to, you know, just like he's not going to extol the virtues of May Pang when he's promoting Double Fantasy.
But I think there's also something to be said for the songs that are more personally meaningful to him.
Right,
okay?
And Walls and Bridges is full of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, we'll get to it in detail later, but, you know, Whatever Gets You Through the Night might have been probably the least personally meaningful, although it's a great record. It's a great snapshot of that partying lifestyle that he had going on at the time.
Yeah.
So for that alone, you know, it's a nice record of things. Anyway, number 9 Dream, Woman.
Yeah, love that.
I have Imagine, but not the studio recording. I have the live performance he did on the Labor Day Telethon in 72.
Why?
Because it doesn't have the strings on it. It's got brass on it. He's backed by Elephant's Memory still. And he changes the lyrics here and there. A Brotherhood and Sisterhood of Man.
Yeah.
easy if you try.
Get more out of that than I do the studio.
Well, because you've really put down Imagine before.
I didn't put it down. I just don't think it's my... people have extolled it as this great anthem, and, you know, I think he's written better songs, and I think that song would have more meaning if he lived it a little more. Instead of
having
a floor to Dakota filled with shoes and fur coats.
That's
a whole other thread that I'm not going to bring onto this show, because I want to keep it focused on the music.
No, I think we should keep that going.
Yeah, you would. Love... Watching the Wheels.
Love that.
Power to the People, which I like more than I probably should, but I think it's a great production. Cold Turkey.
The studio version.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Baby Please Don't Go.
Yeah.
And Nobody Told Me. So those are my greatest hits ones. So I'm not...
Interesting. Nobody Told Me, really.
Great performance, a great record.
I'm Stepping Out from...
Oh, I never cared for that.
Really?
Yeah. Granted, the man didn't get to finish it. So what we have is an unfinished thing. But it's striking to me that he delivered and recorded such a great take on Nobody Told Me, a song that was written for Ringo.
Right.
It's like, why did he even bother?
Well, it's like George with All These Years Ago, you know.
Well, yeah, and there's a whole other story to that. But okay, my actual greatest hits, I wanted to cut off all the singles, all the hits, all the familiar stuff in favor of the more obscure, digging deeper here. And my compilation is called No More Crying.
Why is it called No More Crying?
It's a line from a Lennon song that if you were a big enough fan, you would know.
Oh, zinger.
Oh, anybody here, what song is that from? Thank you. You get the invisible T-shirt.
Yeah, but that's very nice. But why?
Why?
Why have you called
it? Because it's a great song, and I think it has some meaning to him. I know. That's my final track.
But why would you call a greatest hits album No More Crying?
Because it's John Lennon without tears. It's John Lennon as the artist in life, not the person we mourn who was assassinated, that became bigger than life. This is him as the artist, the songwriter, the craftsman, however you want to look at it, whatever prism.
Right.
Okay, so here are the tracks. Isolation. Scared, Out the Blue, exquisite love song that's much overlooked.
Absolutely love that.
Oh My Love, Forgive Me.
Mm-hmm. I don't like that at all.
I like that because it's a jazzy little thing. And to me, you know, he was in the habit of, like every other album, of writing an apology song, you know, with Jealous Guy and Assume a Sin. Forgive Me, Jealous Guy is a great song, but it's almost like, you know, I know you like Child of Nature, its original form.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a good melody is a good melody, no matter what he's singing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the most compelling part of Jealous Guy for me is, rather than it just being a straight-up apology, he's warning her at the end that, yeah, I'm sorry for this, but it's not the end of it either.
Right.
Watch out, babe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am who I am.
Yeah.
And that to me is like, great insight from him.
And great honesty.
Yeah, yeah. So I like that. Okay, forgive me. Every Man Has a Woman, the Yoko song, yes, that they remixed, yeah, for the album of the same name.
Yeah.
It's very haunting when you hear his harmony line mixed to the front as the lead vocal. I think it's a good track. Just Because.
Love that.
End of side one. Side two. New York City.
Yep.
The most, I think I'm not alone in thinking it's the most redeemable track off the Sometime in New York City.
No, I actually like Woman is Nigger of the World.
I think it's a great performance, but I doubt that it's swayed.
The lyrics are weak by his standard, but it's, yeah, a great vocal.
I mean, there's a big case you can make, and there are people in this room that have made that case about the sentiments as he expressed them. There's other ways you could have said what he needed to get across in terms of raising awareness of how women are given a second-class status in society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think going for the stunt phrasing of the title to get attention, he stepped on his own message.
Oh, no, I disagree. I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with, you know, the lyrics about a fat old mother hen. I mean, it just, it's like he's forcing this stuff to rhyme.
Thank you, exactly.
Yeah,
that's kind of a roundabout way of saying what I'm saying, is that it's a little bit too forced, and there's better ways of saying it.
Are you hearing this? I mean, really? What do you mean that was what I was saying? I wasn't saying. I said that I have no problem with the title.
The title.
Yeah, the title.
But then you were talking about the lyrics. I'm talking about the whole thing.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying some of the lyrics in there.
I think the title undermined it, but some of the lyrics were definitely forced.
Yeah, well, I disagree.
Well, okay. Then we don't. Okay, it was a bad point you made. God Save Us, the Lennon vocal version,
yep,
of that.
Yeah.
I thought it's great, you know, 50s sounding performance. I Don't Want to Face It.
Yeah, love that.
Another late Lennon great lyric that, it was one that took a while to grow on me, but it stands up with some of the best work I think he's done. I'm Losing You.
Yeah, now this, I mean, I love the song, but,
however,
and I know a lot of people like the Cheap Trick version, including you.
Yes.
I like it. I know it's edgier, but I think that I think he actually made the right artistic choice. I think the one that went on the album, even though it's slicker, I think it's a bit more cohesive somehow.
Cohesive as a song or as a recording from start to finish?
Yeah.
Okay, because certainly within the context of Double Fantasy,
yeah,
it's as slick as everything else, and Cold Turkey would have stood out like a,
oh, absolutely,
cold sore.
Yeah.
But or not Cold Turkey. The Cheap Trick version, I'm Losing It.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I would have happily in 1980 have had a whole album of John Lennon backed by the guys in Cheap Trick,
yeah,
doing that sort of throwback Plastic Ono Band stuff, 1980 style. That would have been fantastic.
Do you have, I know we haven't got to the end yet, but do you have My Baby Left Me in there?
No.
You know,
are you talking about the bootleg?
Yeah, you know, the where he's got all the sort of chorus with him singing, doing, you know, the call and response.
Yeah.
It's so, that was done for the Rock and Roll Sessions.
Right, right.
And I don't know if that was an idea that was shelved, where they were going to have like a whole chorus of people, like a party, with him singing along. Mm-hmm. I think it's fantastic, actually. I think it really worked. Sad that they didn't put that out or try to do,
yeah,
that with some other tracks.
Yeah, okay. I'm Losing You. Nobody Loves You When You're Down and Out.
Fantastic song.
Fantastic, yeah. The one that he had suggested Sinatra record.
Right.
Because it's not a piece of nothing.
Right.
But it was also, come to find out, he was in that sort of Sinatra mindset of, you know, what he was envisioning. And certainly there's enough about the song to make it applicable to himself at that time, where he was feeling like, you know, an entertainer that used to be, you know, high in the world and just riding the top of the world, and now he's kind of going through this part,
wonderful lyrics.
Yeah.
You know, I've been across the water now so many times. I've seen the one-eyed witch doctor leading the blind.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Everybody loves you when you're 6 foot in the ground.
Yeah.
Okay, Nobody Loves You. Bring It On Home to Me, Send Me Some Loving, medley from Rock and Roll.
Wonderful.
Now, I know you're a bigger fan of the Rock and Roll album than I am.
Am I?
Okay. Yeah, you are.
I much prefer...
I know.
Again, I way prefer the Rock and Roll album to Paul's, you know...
I knew that was coming, too.
CP. Yeah, I am. Yeah. Because Paul tends to turn a lot of the stuff into rockabilly, and I think John left it with more edge.
Well, that's some edge would have helped that album enormously. I thought that, particularly the Spectre tracks... were so bloated and gross that it wiped out any trace of edge.
Although I absolutely love, and obviously it went out on Lennon Anthology, but I love Be My Baby. I think it's just fantastic.
It's okay. I mean, the performances I like on the Rock and Roll album, you know, he did a nice version of Peggy Sue with the extra guitar solo. That was nice. Bebopalula, you know, that the song has got the historic meaning as being...
You know, I actually do love You Can't Catch Me.
I don't like that arrangement.
Really?
Yeah. I don't like... what else is on there?
How about Stand By
Me? Sweet Little 16.
Stand By Me?
That's great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's a great performance.
And that to me
and
is...
Because it's so simple. It's so stark.
And what a great artist Lennon was in terms of he didn't try to, you know, and he couldn't emulate Benny King.
No.
But he does it completely in his style.
He made it his own.
Completely.
Which makes it, you know, fantastic because it was exactly what is most compelling about John. You know, we just did this instrumental show. And we talked about Paul, we talked about George, we talked about Ringo. We didn't talk a whole lot about John. It was not a slight on John. It was not because we thought he was, you know, a not up to snuff instrumentalist. Because plenty of things that he did, you know, the lead guitar solo on You Can't Do That, it's as good as anything.
Yeah.
And there's other things he did too. The acoustic guitar intro to Norwegian Wood, I think is fantastic, and that's him.
And it was his innovation to have the feedback on I Feel Fine.
Sure, but you know, we could have gone down that, but to me, it's not nearly as rich as talking about John Lennon's voice.
I agree.
Because, you know, Paul had the chops as a balladeer and a rock and roll singer. He can do the whole gamut and do it effortlessly. You know, it's like Twist and Shout gets all the kudos for, you know, it's got the myth behind it. Not that's unfactual, but the story that they needed to cut one more song for the Please Please Me album. They only had one take left in him vocally, and he just nailed it.
Yeah.
You know, a frantic guy trying to do his best.
And look at it at the Royal Variety Show. You know, they're all nervous. You can see Paul's nervous.
Yeah, sure.
And again, Lennon could have really gone down in flames on Twist and Shout.
Right.
And he nails it.
But to me, that is equaled by... the studio recording of Long Tall Sally.
Oh, absolutely.
Which I think is amazing, but nobody ever talks about that. It's almost like accepted that, yeah, well, Paul can do this whenever he wants to do his Little Richard. There
well,
it is.
Well, something that we did talk about on a previous episode, which is the Washington Coliseum gig, you know, their first U.S. concert, and they end the show by bringing American rock and roll back to these shores.
Yes.
And they, you know, it's the 1-2 punch. It's
Twist and Shout,
Twist
Long,
and
Tall
Shout and Long Tall Sally.
Yep.
I mean...
They open with Roll Over Beethoven.
Yeah. They just slay everyone.
There's something that is a very singular performance, that concert. I think it was really the last time you saw them firing on all four cylinders as a performing band.
Yeah, they're really excited. They love it.
Yeah, and thank God they were documented so fully.
Yeah.
So it's not just this mythic thing like Carnegie Hall or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to your Lennon.
Okay. Bring It On Home, Send Me Some Loving, and then concluding track, because I did sequence this, I Know, I Know.
Really?
Mind Games. Yes.
Okay. I Like You Are Here.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of Muzak-y, but I like it.
Muzak-y,
yes. You like that?
Right, okay.
And especially coming right before Meat City, described by Tyler and Carr as a noise. It's like, yeah, what else can you call it? But it's a good noise. It's as great a noise as could be made.
So, okay, what, you know, we're talking about Lennon-McCartney solo careers.
Yeah.
Do you, overall, would you be listening more to McCartney solo material than Lennon, or is it a wash? I mean...
I probably listen to more George than either of them, probably because it's less steeped in my consciousness through, you know, airplay. I mean, you know, George had his handful of hit singles, but the real riches lie on the album tracks.
I also think, actually, that George, and I've come to appreciate this more over time, that I think George really retained the spirit of the Beatles.
Yeah.
The sound. You know, anything that George produced by Splinter or whoever it was.
Badfinger.
Badfinger. You'd hear that Beatles sound. And what I came to realize was how much he really did contribute to the Beatles sound that he didn't really get credited for.
No, he really didn't. And I think that is proof enough. What he did on his own has that Beatley quality.
Yeah.
And not in a dismissive way, but just the construction of his material.
Yeah.
It is so well put together.
Yeah.
You know, every guitar part, every harmony, you know, everything is mapped out beautifully. Now, you could say he's not spontaneous, but maybe that wasn't really his long suit.
Yeah.
You know, orchestrating the whole thing. You know, Paul would have his moments of going for the spontaneity with, you know, varying results. You know, Wildlife comes up a little short. I think it's a pretty common consensus.
A little short?
Well,
a little short.
A lot of short. Your mileage may vary. But Paul was also a craftsman. John was a craftsman. Now, to circle back to the original question that this show was to cover, creative peaks, what would you say? Is there something you can point to as a creative peak of either one of them, in your opinion?
Well, commercially, you know, creative peak for Paul had to be the kind of 73 to 75 period. You know, Band on the Run through Venus and Mars, and he's touring the world, and he's selling out. And that was like his second coming. But artistically, looking back, I was really happy at the time that he was having all these hit records. Mm-hmm. You know, I was really pleased about that. But now I think a lot of them have dated, not really, you know, just not really my taste. But
right.
I suppose a creative peak solo for me would be the Band on the Run album.
Hmm.
It's not an album I'm playing much these days, but That to me is a peak. Lennon, I would say definitely Plastic Ono Band, Imagine, and Walls and Bridges, actually.
Okay, so that's a...
Yeah, I think there's a dip with Sometime in New York City and Mind Games. Mind Games, he's kind of regrouping. He's kind of treading into there.
It's a retreat back to what he did best, coming off...
But I suppose if I was going to say his peak, I think he kicks off with... I think it's Plastic Ono Band and Imagine.
See, Lennon himself described Imagine as Plastic Ono Band with sugar on it, or chocolate, however you want to describe it. I thought it's an okay album. I'm not crazy about the Spector production. It sounds like you've got cotton in your ears. It's like too much of it is muted. And
I mean, I agree. Like Jealous Guy, which I think is a fabulous song, I love the arrangement, but the sound, the actual sonic quality of that track isn't great at all.
No, it's not. And I would say it's true of some of the early Wing stuff, especially even when they remastered it, the drums still sound crappy, and you know it's too bad, but there it is. And I would go so far as to maybe agree that some of it does sound dated, more in the production. It sounds more 70s than timeless.
What are you talking about, Wings?
I'm talking some of the Wings, not all the Wings.
And I think those kind of trademark backing vocals, I know that was the Wing sound, you know, Linda's backing vocals. But
it's not a bad sound.
It's a very M.O.R. sound. I don't know.
It was a good blend. For a woman who was not a trained singer, who was not a trained musician
of any kind. As we heard
from
the isolated track of
Right,
Hey
and I thought that was kind of cruel, putting that out there. I mean, nobody needed to prove that Linda was not a musician.
It wasn't me, I swear. I didn't do that.
Get my eye on you. But blending with Denny Lane, that was a very canny thing, because it became this defining sound of Wings.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Paul is still Paul, no matter what setting you put him on. But even the harmonies on the Ram album, and again, you know, we've kind of covered this to death, and I want to, you know, dig that grave again, but I think it's a fantastic sounding album in terms of the sheer musical invention, and I think it showed that Paul had a tendency, like a lot of people, when he was comfortable, he did not produce his best work. When he had his back against the wall in terms of, at that time, you know, he was suing the other three Beatles, he was still being thought of as the guy who broke up the Beatles, every critic had the knives out for him, starting with the McCartney album and on to Ram, you know, which he absolutely, his approach changed back to, okay, you didn't like the McCartney album, I'll give you Abbey Road Part 2. I'll go out and use my skill set as a producer and arranger.
Well, yeah, that's where we agree to differ, because you think it's Abbey Road Part 2.
I mean, to the extent that I like Abbey Road, which is not my favorite album.
I think it's got aspirations of being Abbey Road
Part
2.
But I think, this is what I say about Ram, is that not only is all his array of talents as a singer, as a producer, arranger, it's all there. I mean, there's so many musical ideas flying by, and there's absolute thought put behind how these things are arranged and presented. I mean, it's inescapable, except to you.
No, but he also, I get the production values. I just don't think the actual material itself holds up.
But that's, I think, that the gloss hides the anger that is in those groups, that he was feeling. I think he felt misunderstood by the world.
Well, then get rid of the gloss and let's hear the anger. Why hide it?
Because that's not who he was at that time. I think that, he had the mission of showing that he was the guy that was responsible for some of the Beatles' slickest stuff, because, you know, the critics were kicking him for the underproduction of McCartney. But there's the anger that was going on in his life, you know, what he talked about on the show, Wrote All Night, you know, manifest there, which he kept in his pocket. And it's there between the grooves. And so you've got, when he sings about something like he means it, you know, he's as good as anybody to ever cut a record.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you hear that throughout the Imagine album. So as much as it pains me to say that Paul peaked in 1971, I think that that is where he had the whole package out there. And you saw glimpses of it here and now throughout the rest of his career, but never sustained start to finish over an album the same way. I thought that, again, Band on the Run, he had his back against the wall, mm-hmm. something to prove. He's going to go ahead and make this album, notwithstanding the fact that his lead guitarist and his drummer have just quit, and he's going off to Lagos to make this album that he committed to, and, you know, he's going to do it. So, unlike its predecessor, Red Rose Speedway, it really hangs together and has got that spark about it that, you know, it sounds like an album that meant something to him.
I mean, for me, the pattern of Paul's solo career is he does, from what I would call a good album, I don't think they hold up like all the tracks. There's usually like up and downs in every album. But he'll have a good album, like Band on the Run, and then follow it up with an okay album that's not as good, and then it kind of slides down over the course of the next few albums, and then he'll come back with another good one. I mean, the same with Flowers in the Dirt.
Great album.
Yeah, a really good album. And then I thought personally, like Off the Ground, I thought was just
a
horrible.
Step down?
I'd say a giant tumble down, actually.
Well, my take on that, there was an awful lot of material he recorded, as you know, that filtered out on the B-sides of like the million singles he was putting out. And again, you have an example of Paul not necessarily being the best judge of his own material, where the stuff that made it to the album maybe wasn't as strong as the stuff that either he held back or parceled out, where it wouldn't really get the full light of day on these B-side of singles or bonus tracks. So it's a pity. And, you know, maybe when they do the remaster reissue of that, where it's going to be the whole kit and caboodle, as it were. Gotcha. It will maybe get some of its due that it should have.
Yeah.
And then, or, you know, might be like Red Rose Speedway, where you see the stuff that he held back. It's like, what the hell was he thinking? Why didn't this make it to the album? A Lennon peak, you know, right out of the box, the Plastic Ono Band is such a singular achievement. It could not possibly be replicated.
I agree.
And you would fail if you tried. It's like making Hard Day's Night twice.
Well, that's why he did a lushly arranged follow-up.
Well, yeah, he did a bit of a deviation, although it was sort of a variation on the theme. But I don't think he really got it back together again for a full-length album until Walls and Bridges, where I think the songwriting quality is Plastic Ono Band worthy. It's all deeply felt personal stuff. You know, Scared, What You Got, Bless You, any number of great personal statements
but
that he made.
I mean, imagine, you know, you've got Give Me Some Truth, and you've got Oh My Love, and, you know, you've got Crippled Inside. And
I'm not a fan of some of those songs as much as you are.
Right. I think he's still really on top of his game there.
What I value more about his, when he's going to write a love song, if he makes it where it's clearly, demonstrably about Yoko, I mean, everybody knew who he was married to, you know, just like they knew who Paul was married to. Paul could write a Maybe I'm Amazed and a My Love and a Warm and Beautiful. Everybody knew it was about Linda. When John makes his songs that specific, it's almost exclusionary.
No, I don't agree.
That's why I like an Oh My Love better than an Oh Yoko, or a Bless You better than Dear Yoko. It's like,
well,
we know
like
who
Dear
he's
Yoko.
Singing about, but he didn't, you know, making it so that everybody can draw their own meaning out of it and make it, you know, heartfelt to them, I think that was his true gift. You know, when he invested his personal life and made it universal in his songs, you know, he was at the top of his game. And wherever he did that, and that's why I say the Walls and Bridges album, because there's any number of things that don't have to be too Lennon-specific that you can draw things from that might resonate in your own life.
Mm. Yeah, as I said, for me, I think Lennon's solo career was actually really good. I think, you know, Sometime in New York City was definitely a mistake. It had some great tracks, but it was definitely very patchy. Same for Mind Games. I think it was a comeback of sorts, but it still didn't, you know.
Well, the production was rushed. Yeah. It was him producing himself. And when, what was it, 2006 that the remixes came out?
Yeah.
I thought it came off as a much better album than it did in 1973.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, you really got what he was trying to do there. And I would only downgrade it by some of the material.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, like you say, he was reaching back to what he did best, but he hadn't quite hit it yet the way he would at Walls and Bridges.
The thing that interests me, I mean, we talk about how much I love, you know, Lennon's work, but the one thing that does occur to me is that after sort of 1972, really after some time in New York City, we don't get the John Lennon anymore who's experimenting, you know, sonically or, you know, he's not pushing the envelope. That's what Lennon did, right? Right through, you know, Tomorrow Never Knows, mm-hmm. and, you know, Day in the Life, and, you know,
Revolution 9.
Happiness is a Warm Gun. Yeah, Revolution 9. He's always pushing the envelope. And then the Plastic Ono Band album, mm-hmm. right? Where, you know, again, in a different way, he's pushing the envelope.
Cold Turkey.
Yeah, by the time of Mind Games and thereafter, he doesn't do that anymore.
No.
He plays it safe.
The circumstance had changed. I think that he really hit his peak as a solo performing artist with Walls and Bridges because not only did he get back on track and hit that sweet spot as a songwriter?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that from start to finish, I think they're all great songs.
Because it was heartfelt.
It was heartfelt, absolutely. Yeah. He wasn't preaching. He wasn't, you know, building a shrine to Yoko on that album. It was universal. And that,
although the whole album, apart from Surprise, Surprise, Sweet Bird of Paradox, mm-hmm. that whole album is about him missing Yoko.
That's part of it. I think, you know, there are flashes of that throughout the songs. But I think part of it was also recognizing that, you know, he was an adult now. And you know you can't be partying like you're 18. And
why not?
Because it kills people, as he would find out with Keith. And
well, you know. Keith's still around.
No, Moon.
Oh, that Keith. Okay.
Yeah, I'm John's Keith. Yeah. but also the production. You know, he had really worked on his learning curve between Mind Games, and then you've got the Harry Nilsson album Pussycats, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it's half oldies, half great personal songs. It's like the missing link between rock and roll and Walls and Bridges.
Yeah.
There it is. And then he finally hit it with Walls and Bridges, where he had the accessibility with the personal songs.
The other thing we've got to also take into consideration for all of them, for all four, well, certainly three of the Beatles, is, you know, here they are writing original material. They've already been doing it for year after year after year and having tremendous hit rate. And as John said, if you just take the best three or four songs from each of our solo albums and put them together and make your kind of own Beatle album,
right.
It's true, they would still have been sustaining a remarkably high level of...
That's the thing. I've written two books now from 1970 to 1980 covering that rich, rich period before the Beatles passed into history. And there were 30 albums of original material made from 1970 to 1980 by the solo Beatles. I don't think they'd run out of gas. You know, no. You know, there's this mentality, well, they quit at the right time when everything was still golden before they declined. Bull. They had plenty of good material in them. 90% of what John and Paul are going to be remembered for are the songs that were credited Lennon-McCartney. Yeah. I think that if you pulled the three best songs off every one of those albums, recorded them as Beatles, those four guys, they'd still be golden.
Yeah, I think what happened in the solo years, what happened in the 70s, really, is their solo work did reveal their personal flaws more. If you look at each of them.
Absolutely.
You know, John
Paul and
George.
The quality control was gone.
Yeah.
The balance was gone.
Absolutely. And that was the difference in the Beatles. Not only the collaborative effort in the studio, the sound that they produced, but also, yeah, the quality control.
I don't think that most people picked up on it or might necessarily even agree until they really check it out, but I think that George had the most consistent rate of his output, maintaining a certain standard. Mm. Even albums that people tend to slag, like, you know, Dark Horse, because his voice is ravished.
Extra Texture.
Extra Texture, to me, is like him doing a soul album. And yeah, it's kind of downbeat, but that's where he was at, and it's still pretty well
crafted. But the production values are pretty poor.
It was rushed, yeah. I'll give you that. But I think the reasoning for that is that he, alone out of the rest of them, except for the one-offs, you know, the recording with Elton, recording with Bowie, recording with Michael Jackson, he was much more adept at collaborating with people on his artistic level.
Absolutely.
And the others, you know, they were virtually slumming with Journeyman.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be Elephant's Memory, and with all due respect, they're nice guys, and the guys in Wings.
Yeah.
You know, neither one were with people that challenged them.
Right.
And challenging each other was what made the Beatles great. John and Paul challenging each other. You know, you're going to write And I Love Her? Okay, I guess I have to write, you know, If I Fell.
If I Fell.
And all down the line.
Yeah.
So lacking that challenge, that's where you see the diminishing returns.
Well, I mean, you know, in John's case, the misdirection is sometime in New York City where he's suddenly taking up every political cause on the planet.
He's taking other people's sentiments and
grievances. And he can't do that with sincerity. So
right. There's
a flaw there. You know, McCartney, I mean, I don't know where to start, but I mean, it's just a lack of application, I think. It's a kind of arrogance that he thinks, I can just knock out these songs. And again, from personal experience, when I've spoken with people who worked with him, whether it was Eric Stewart, or Hugh Padgham, who produced the Press the Play album, they said that they thought that the songs that they were presented with hadn't been finished yet in terms of the writing process.
Right.
And he sort of said, no, they're done. And they just said it was just a lack of application. And again, they put that, maybe it was, you know, he was smoking something, but it was just like he wasn't applying himself.
But when he did shine and rise to the occasion, it would be through some sort of challenge. Mm. You know, Band on the Run, you know, he's got to regroup and, you know, play the drums himself, play the lead guitar himself, you know, so he's going to be tasked mightily for that album. But the next time you see him, in my opinion, consistently rising to the occasion was when he was working with Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
Who would not, you know, be blind to your Beatleness. It's like, I'm going to call you on your nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, and here's another question. I know it's a John and Paul show, but George, we're talking about George. What happened to George's voice from about 73 onwards? It goes into this much more whiny quality.
Yeah.
So just a different tone of voice. And that's before, you know, he has the vocal problems.
Well, do you think some of it would be the abuse he was giving himself in 73, 74, 75,
yeah,
where he's partying hard?
There's just less breath on the vocal. Suddenly it's a whiny sound.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's could be any number of factors. Again, I always thought, you know, he was somebody that tended to produce himself. When he did go producer shopping and he got Russ Titelman from Warner Brothers to produce the George Harrison album, I thought it was nice that he crafted an album that had a consistency to it. It wasn't patchy. And if you like that sort of sound, which was very mellow, I mean, the only difference between him at that time and John from 75 to 80 was George still had a record contract in effect. But they were both relaxing. You know, they both had a child. They both were like stepping back from the rock star thing. I thought, how brilliant would it have been if instead of a Russ Titelman, he'd got somebody like a Lindsey Buckingham to produce him.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that knew pop inside and out, you know, that was a big enough Beatle fan that he knew where George's strengths lie and was a great guitar guy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you think of it, you know, John obviously was cut off in the prime of life, you know, so there's no way of knowing where he would have gone. But he was certainly playing it safe with, you know, Double Fantasy, Stroke Milk and Honey. I don't think it was his finest work. Some of it, you know, Woman, as you said, fantastic. But
did you ever look at the song, speaking of Double Fantasy, did you ever consider starting over as being at least a veiled, I mean, yeah, starting over, he was resuming his career, but I can never hear that song without thinking of him pitching that song or having Paul in mind when he sang it.
Really? I never thought of that.
I mean, on the one hand, he's picking up where he left off with the rock and roll album with this, as he called it, Elvis Orbison sound.
Yes.
But then there's that whole, it's time to spread your wings and fly, don't let another day go by,
right,
my love. It's like, how many Paulisms can you squeeze into a couplet? And if it wasn't conscious, it certainly had to be subconscious.
But what I was going to say is that, you know, I think in Paul's case, the problem is he should have put out less material.
Is there a ratio you have in mind?
Well, I don't know. Oh, in my case, yeah, let's not go there. But I do think that if he'd have filtered more, we'd have had, you know, a higher standard. But what I was going to say is, in terms of at the end of a career, in George's case, if we look at, you know, the last decade or so, I mean, you've got Cloud Nine, which I think is a superb album. I know it's very Jeff Lynne and it's, you know,
yeah,
very ELO,
that would be my rap on that. I think the songs are great, the performances are generally good, great slide guitar,
right,
but I'm not a big fan of the Jeff Lynne sound.
Okay, but I do love that album. What he did with the Wilburys was superb.
Yes.
What, you know, what a super group that was. And
I think, working with equals.
Yes, and then Brainwashed. I actually think that's one of the great posthumously released albums of all time. It's a superb album.
You know, everybody points to All Things Must Pass as his creative peak, as though he did nothing worthy after that. It was his commercial peak and the greatest selling ex-Beatle solo album. But I would put in the top three, certainly All Things Must Pass, 33 and a Third, and Brainwashed.
I totally agree. Mm-hmm. And I also find All Things Must Pass these days, I love the material. I find some of it difficult to listen to as a complete album because it's like, God, the amount of echo that Spector's put on there. Yeah. And George said as much. He said he'd like
to
have
the temptation to remove it in 2001. Yeah. And, you know, someday I'm sure Danny will revisit
that. By the way,
that.
I did hate his re-recording of My Sweet Lord, though, in 2000. Again, the vocal was just terrible.
Yeah. Well, it was Dylan-esque.
Oh, right. Yeah, really. So anyway, I think it's time to wrap it up, isn't it?
Well, until somebody kicks us off, who's coming up next? Oh, you are. Okay. All right. Then we shall wrap it up.
But I suppose we could throw out just a couple of questions.
Sure.
Anyone have any questions?
Yes, sir.
I'm just curious why you kept Maybe I'm Amazed off your list.
I think it's a really good song, and
the question is for everybody listening on the podcast at home, why did you leave Maybe I'm Amazed off your list, Richard?
Right. Because it's just personal taste. As I said, it's not what I think a record company should put out as a greatest hits album. It's just the songs I listen to. I like the song when he's done it in concert. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's just not one of those ones that I usually play.
Let's see a show of hands. Who likes the studio recording better than the live one, the 76 live one? Very interesting. Few hands. So the rest of you, I can presume, like the live one better than the studio one?
Wow.
Very interesting. That's I wouldn't have expected that result.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have a question, Susan?
You talked earlier about Paul's voice. Do you think some of that stems from his stubborn refusal to ever alter the key of a song?
Do we think that some of Paul's vocal problems stem from his stubborn refusal to ever change the key of a song? Yeah, I think that there is that, and I think it ties in with his stubborn refusal to also have any vocal coaching or do anything about it. Yeah.
Good question.
I agree about Paul's voice. It's terrible. But you remember talking about Paul going to the studio with songs that weren't quite finished and seeing it work. If George Martin did it to him on Tug of War, he said he put all the songs not finished, go back and finish.
Yeah, that is absolutely true.
Can you restate that?
The question was, again, that when I referred to the fact that on the Press to Play album, for instance, that the producer and his co-producer, co-writer, Eric Stewart, was saying that a lot of the material wasn't completed as far as I thought compositionally. And here we were asked the question, wasn't that also the case with the Tug of War album, with George Martin saying go back? Absolutely, that is the case. And, you know, I sort of listened to something like Freedom, where he's decided to write an anthem about, you know, the tragedy in New York City. And he had an opportunity there. It was a moment in time. And what does he do? He just pulls the, you know, the melody from If I Had a Hammer and stuck some basic lyrics around it. And again, to me, it was just a lack of application. There's no doubt the man's genius. I mean, he's, you know, incredible talent. I think it's a lack of application.
Well, Richard, you've wrapped up this show singing Paul's praises in a way I never could have predicted. Well done.
You're welcome, yeah.
We'll phone you.
So, my name is Richard Buskin.
I'm Robert Rodriguez.
And this has been
Something About the Beatles. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
I am only learning to tell. Something About the Beatles, recorded at Strad Studios, produced by Thomas Rapetney. Executive producer, Rick Way. Title song recorded by the Corgis.
The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy.